Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you on a pleasantly breezy afternoon in the mountains of Utah. Before we begin, I just want to let you know that there is a content warning for this episode. There is some swearing. So if you happen to be my mother, or listen with little kids around, maybe come back to this one later. If you don't mind, then forge ahead. My guest today is novelist and comedy writer Robert Brockway. Robert got his start during what many of my listeners will think of as the golden age of crack.com, editing and writing funny articles that were read by hundreds of thousands of people every week. Robert's comedy chops have since moved on to co-found 1900hotdog.com. Robert is also the author of the post-apocalyptic horror novel, Carrier Wave, and The Vicious Circuit, an urban fantasy series from Tor Books. Robert and I discuss his early days at crack.com, the responsibility of making people laugh, the difficulty of managing mental and physical health while creating, and the horrors of being thrown into the deep end of public speaking as a new author. Enjoy my conversation with Robert Brockway. How do you feel about Cheetos?
How do I feel about Cheetos? I feel ambivalent about standard Cheetos these days. I kind of like the crunchy ones, and I'm all about the white cheddar baked puffs.
Yeah, I realized that I have never had anything but original Cheetos.
Really? You haven't had the deviants, the mutations Cheetos have thrown off?
No, like because I've got friends that like swear by the like flaming Cheetos or whatever they're called.
Yeah,
like,
I can't do those anymore. My body hates me enough. It doesn't need any help.
Right, we're getting old, right?
Yeah, I'm getting old in just rapid like Lost Crusade time. I picked the wrong grail is what's happening to me right now.
It's the worst. How have you been doing?
I've been doing okay. I mean, my body's garbage, but I'm coming to peace with that fact. Work's been good. I hear there's a plague on.
But you haven't noticed.
No, I've basically just been working. I mean, there's like three or four times where I look up and around like, I'd like to go do this. Oh, I shouldn't go do that. And that's it. Like my life as a person who works a lot indoors by themselves on a computer is mercifully, I guess, unaffected. Aside from, you know, general terror.
You don't think it's like you don't feel like oppressed by the whole thing or like you've cut your social life or anything like that?
I certainly feel like there's a plague on. I mean, there's like a general psychic malaise that comes along with living through a fucking pandemic. But like my social life was never great. Like I did this, you know, even when I worked at Cracked full time. And then I wrote books in my spare time. So I went from one computer and I would try to use a different computer to make it feel like I was doing something different. Those are little tricks, little fun tricks you have when you're an isolated workaholic, I guess. But no, it's not too dramatically different for me. It was nice for like a week there when we were allowed to go out and do stuff, especially in Connecticut, which had a really good vaccination rate and didn't see a lot of cases. We went out and did, I believe, three things the past year and a half. So those three things were real fun.
Did you say you're in Connecticut now?
Yeah, I'm in Connecticut now. My wife's from here.
When did you move?
It's almost a year ago now. Almost been here a year. It'll be September. We'll be here a year.
So you moved during the middle of the pandemic.
We moved in the middle of the pandemic. It was terrible. I do not recommend it. It was the most stressful thing and nothing worked and everything was closed and you had to disinfect everything. So we still thought it was mostly touch-based, mostly surface-based at that point. And staying in hotels, it probably took like a good 4 years off my life of just stressing all the way across the country.
Well, I bet, because moving at best is always stressful.
And then moving across the country sucks a lot. We moved from Tucson, Arizona to to Connecticut. So it was like 3,000 miles in 4 days. It was awful.
Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's rough.
It was rough. It definitely, hey, there's probably a reason why my body is garbage now. I bet that just destroyed me.
Just aged you significantly.
That was my wrong grail. I picked the wrong grail, a wrong moment to do that big move.
Was it like a work thing for your wife, or was it just you guys wanted to be closer to your family? Or
yeah, just closer to her family. We moved to Tucson just because I liked Tucson, and I was having like real problems with living in Portland after 20 years of just rain all the time, and it finally like crept up on me all at once. So we both like Tucson. We moved there, and then Megan's family is here. So we didn't have anything keeping us there.
Yeah, that was basically why I left Cleveland, is because I was just like, I'm so sick of rain all the time. And
yeah,
if it's not raining, it's cloudy.
Yeah, I did 20 years of that, and that is quite enough.
It's oppressive. You know, it kind of beats you up.
It is. It really does. It just wears you down. I was very, very just weary all the time. And then the doctor was like, your vitamin D levels, because I had one of those doctors that loves to measure those. Like, you sometimes get them. It's like, they're the lowest I've ever seen. And I live in Portland. I've been practicing for decades. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
that's probably a problem.
Were you, when you worked at Crack, did you work out of an office, or were you just at home?
We did for a little bit. We tried that as kind of an experiment. And back in like right when they first hired me, I had to move down to Santa Monica in 2011. Well, 10 years ago. Wow, that didn't feel like 10 years ago. I got some stuff to think about. Anyway, we tried it for, I don't know, a couple of years, and some of the other folks liked it and they stuck around. And then after just all of the stuff that went down with Cracked, nobody had to stay anymore. So a lot of us just scattered back to where we came from. I went back to Portland, but I was ruined by Southern California. I was just, my body would not accept Portland again.
Yeah, that's, man, it's weird how you like, when you're young, you don't even seem to notice the weather. And then like there's a like an age you reach, and then you're suddenly like looking around at the weather all the time. You're checking it. You're looking outside. You're like looking through your blinds, you know, just
glaring at the clouds. I see you about to do something. Get the hell out of here.
Right. It's like the worst feeling.
Yeah. And it really was Southern California that broke me. It was 20 years of rain. And then I went to Southern California for like 2 years and tried to go back to the rain, and my body just rebelled. Would not take it.
What are you working on these days?
I've been getting more into screenwriting in my like off time. But my day job now is 1-900-HOT-DOG.com. I guess this counts as my plug too. It's a comedy site. It's a daily comedy site that me and Sean Baby, also formerly from Cracked, and everything else on the internet, formerly Done Everything. We just write daily comedy. We have our own podcast, the Dog Zone 9000, where we just crack jokes. And the idea behind that is that we don't want to do everything that the big content age was all about, where it was chasing algorithms, chasing titles, and doing, you know, downer stuff and insulting people's favorite things. So we just want to do funny, interesting stuff again. We find like cursed artifacts and review them. And that's been my day job. That's most of my time. And then my off time, I've been getting into screenwriting, which has been very interesting and very hard to switch gears from books. I'm fighting books the whole time, just me and books against each other, trying to turn them into scripts.
Right, because it's such a different thing, because they feel so, especially because like you write pretty fat books.
I have. My last book was like 800 something pages. Before that, they weren't. Like the Vicious Circuit trilogy that I did with Tor. Each of those was probably around 300 pages. They were nice and lean. And then I stopped for like 2 years to write Carrier Wave, which was 800 something pages, and it was awful. And I guess I decided I'm going to write screenplays now because they're like 20,000 words tops.
Yeah. And but it's like a totally different, like you said, it's a totally different gear you have to be in your brain.
Yeah. Like you're sort of tempted by like, oh, well, they're short. It's only 20,000 words. But coming from books, you're like, I can't do this in 20,000 words. I can't do all of this. You want me to have characters and arcs, and you want me to like set up motifs and plot threads and then deliver. Ah, it's so tough. I just give me just like 40,000 more words, please. Right.
Right. Nobody's going to turn down an 800-page screenplay.
Right. That's all I need.
It'll be fine.
I'll be the first. I'll be the one that makes it worth it. I'll be like the Alan Moore with his million-word novel.
Just a 12-hour movie. It's very marketable, I promise.
Right. We get all of the stuff that you get in a 2-hour movie. I promise. Just 12 hours of it.
It'll be fine. Theaters won't mind.
Zack Snyder can do it now, right? We're opening the door for 12-hour movies.
Right. Oh, man. And they're like, there's like rumors going around that there's like a 4 to 6 hour cut of Dune.
You don't need the extra time. I've read, I don't know, the first like 6 Dune books or whatever the number was back in the day. No, there was like 6 or something. I read like the first 3, and that was plenty. The first one I loved so much. The second one was like, oh, third one, like, I have to do it. I said I'd do it.
I adore Dune. Like, the original Dune is top 5 books.
Such a good book.
Easily. It's so good.
Got me through 2 other books of Dune.
Yeah, I'll admit that I would watch a 6-hour Dune. I might hate myself after it, but I'd still do it.
Yeah, I would do it just to know.
But I'm one of those people that, like, watching, like, Blade Runner 2049, like, I was living for those like long, lonely shots of sci-fi scapes and stuff like that. I adored that.
Right, but that was good. That was a good movie. and they did a good job on it. I think that's the difference between a lot of these, between my 12-hour movie and Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
I think the difference is a goodness.
What do you find, like, because we talked a little bit about shifting gears in terms of scripts and stuff, but do you find that you struggle with switching between like novel writing or even screenplays to the kind of the short form comedy?
Yeah.
Is that weird?
Yeah, it's weird. Each of the formats is weird because I'm still working on a book. Like, I finished my first draft of a book and I got some good feedback that is going to make a substantial teardown of the book that I'm going to have to redo. And so I'm trying at some point to also think about that and get like book gears working, get screenplay gears working, but then also my daily job of writing comedy all the time. I don't have, you know, an article every day. It takes me more than a day to write an article, but we have multiple articles a week. And then we have like a comedy podcast. So I have like 6 different storytelling gears to go through. And sometimes you come into it and you're writing like a book, like it's a comedy article. Yeah, like, no, I'm like riffing on something in the book. I'm like, no, you can't do this. Or I try to bring books into like scripts, and then I'm writing like exposition in the action lines of a script. Like, I can't get away with any of that. You have to just either figure out a way to switch gears, which sometimes, oftentimes for me, is just going back and rereading stuff until my brain sort of picks up the cadence of what I'm doing. And that also helps with editing. I mean, the more passes you can do on something, the better it's going to be. So it never, you know, harms you to go back and read through that stuff. But sometimes I'll have to go read something else. I'll have to go read like one of Sean's articles on the site or something to get like my brain targeting this thing. Or I'll have to read a bit of a book, or I'll have to open up a script or watch a movie or something that just makes your brain think in those patterns. Because they're very different patterns.
Yeah, you said something that I'm interested by, because like a lot of writers, I don't really ever hear anybody talk about this, but I always think of writing in terms of cadence, in terms of like kind of the beats that once you become an experienced writer, you just kind of naturally know the beats of, you know, a narrative or even an article or, you know, whatever it is you're working on. And it's weird because I often will, you know, I'll do a podcast or I'll do a guest article or something, or I'll even just do like a Reddit AMA and they'll say, oh, what's your advice for this thing? And I kind of, sometimes I feel like really at loss, because like a lot of the writing I do is very instinctual. Like you get somebody like Brandon Sanderson who lives to figure out the science of writing. Mm-hmm. And he categorizes every little thing. And I feel like I write by instinct so much more than that.
Yeah, me too. It's very much like my only writing advice that I have a few pieces of writing advice, and the only really useful one I have is just write a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, do it. And if you're having problems, like, is this not going to be any good? It's probably not very good. that's not the point. You gotta just do it.
Yeah.
And it's gonna be garbage and maybe you'll have to throw it away, but then you'll do something else. And that's like almost exactly where I am with screenplays right now. Like I'm iterating and iterating and reiterating on a concept to try to get the best draft I can. And I know when I'm done, it's probably going in the trash, but you have to do it. You have to do it until it works. And like, maybe I know everybody learns differently. I think that's one of the best things I've learned as I get older is exactly how I learn. Like the method then, and more importantly, what doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
And it's the Brandon Sanderson style. Not that there's anything against it. Some people just learn, work, break things down in that fashion. And I don't. I can't like read a book about something and then immediately go practice it. I have to read that book after I've done it and failed a few times. And then I read the book and go, okay, this is what the book, so I should have done this way. Like I just have to do things in my own order. And so, yeah, it's a lot of instinctual flow and pacing. And that's kind of what makes it hard to learn something new is you get frustrated. Like if this was a damn book, I would have this on lock by now. And it's not, and I don't.
Yeah. I think about that in terms of like, I guess in terms of learning something and like reading about writing, like you said, it's like, it's almost useless if you haven't done it yet because your brain hasn't filled in the context of what all the advice is about. So you don't even, it's like having a mechanic say to you, oh, the flibberty gibbet underneath the other thing, that's what you have to do. And you're like, I don't know what any of those words mean.
Right. Well, I mean, that's how our brains work. But some people are like, I'm going to read that book. Like I used to know a guy that would, well, I know a guy. He was like my car parts guy when I was working on old cars.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go in there and he said like, well, you just get the manual. And he gave me like a manual. He's just read it cover to cover and then you'll have it. I'm like, no, dude. I did my best. I read like 50 pages of just not understanding a single word. I didn't retain any of that information. It didn't help me at all. And I could never make him understand that because that's how he learned. That's how he taught himself. He sat down and he read a book cover to cover and then he went out to the car and was like, oh, this is what the book was talking about. And then just did it. I'm like, I don't learn that way. I can't do that way. What I have to do is I have to go out there and just ruin a car. I have to go out there with a hammer and some fire and just destroy something beautiful. And then afterwards I have to be like, well, I shouldn't have done that. So what next time, what can I not do? What can I not do out of this? And like that's my learning process. It's pretty good. It's pretty good now that I know it. Now that I know that and embrace it. Like I can work with it.
Right. Like I think most creative careers are kind of learning how you function inside of a inside of like a mechanism where everybody's different, because it's not like accounting or something where you have solid numbers and you just learn how to do databases. You kind of have to learn how your brain wraps itself around all of this stuff and then create something.
Totally. Yeah, that's definitely, I mean, that was, and that's the struggle, at least for me, the first few years I was doing it. I was trying to figure out how I do this. And in doing that, I was trying on everybody else's advice. I was trying on other people's techniques and it just didn't necessarily work. I didn't really produce anything usable in that time. I did my first book, RX, which was like a sci-fi novel that I guess it sold pretty well. It did pretty well. A lot of people still talk to me about how they like it.
Yeah.
But I mean, after a few years, once I had figured it out, I'd gone back and like looked at it, hated it so much that I pulled it. I just pulled it. It's gone. It's off of the internet now. I'm trying to figure out a way to like rework it. Maybe I can go back and edit. I'm probably never going to have that time. I probably just have to accept like I did not know what I was doing and I gave it to people and they enjoyed it. And I'm glad they enjoyed it. But I cannot in good conscience leave that out in the world.
So you actually put a book out and then pulled it later?
Yeah. I put a book out in 2012, I think RX was. Because my very first book was called Everything is Going to Kill Everybody. And that's out of print just from a publisher. But that was all that really was cracked articles. Like it was a collection of essays around a theme, which was the apocalypse.
Yeah.
And like the real ways the apocalypse would happen. And like I could do much better than that now. Some of the jokes haven't aged well. But it was still a skill set I had at that time. So it wasn't so far outside. And then I knew I wasn't ready for an actual book. So I wrote RX as a serial novel. I wrote a part and then I put it out there. And I devised like this complicated system where you could wind up getting just the whole thing for free. And I put that out there and I took feedback on each part as it came along. And then I instituted that part for that feedback for the next part. So like I learned as I went, I took feedback from people as I went. I thought, this is a really good idea. Nobody's ever done this before. And it turns out there's a reason nobody had ever done that before. Because it was a bad idea. Yeah. It's so much work, so much more work than just writing a normal book to like go back and like try to fix all these things. And it didn't end up hanging together well. But again, like that was me ruining that car. I had to go out there with this book and just be like, everybody stand back. Stand back. Put on your ponchos. I got a sledgehammer. I'm going to Gallagher this son of a bitch all over the place. And I learned from that.
That's good. I think that like a lot of times when you look at like little baby writers, like taking their creative writing classes or whatever, that you often have people that like you have people on the two ends of the spectrum, like that either they have zero self-confidence. And so they won't finish things. They won't, you know, kind of go through and kind of do the process in the first place. Or you have people with all the self-confidence who are so convinced that they are the next Stephen King that they just don't learn from anything.
Yeah. And I honestly, it's probably the only time I'll ever say this, but I'm very thankful for my wildly fluctuating self-esteem. Because I have both of those extremes where I'll be writing something or just more likely editing something. And I never really feel like this is pure genius as I'm writing something. But sometimes I'll come across like passages or just the structure, maybe even a whole story, and I'm editing and I'll come slowly commits like, I'm a genius. This is the best thing I've ever written. And then I'll revisit the next day and be like, this is garbage. God damn it. It's all garbage. I can't use any of this. So I think between the two, I wish I could just always be at that medium level where like, I'm pretty good. I got stuff to learn, but no, it's just megalomania or just in the dumps depression.
Do you kind of, as somebody who, like you said, you're a bit of a workaholic and you're just at home at your computer all the time, do you do anything to try to kind of manage your mental health?
No, and it has not been a good idea. Yeah. don't follow my example. My physical health too. Like I just, like all of my problems are work-based. I really messed up my back. My eyeballs are giving out. Like, because especially once we started 1-900 Hot Dog, because the last few years it cracked. I was so depressed. I didn't want to do it. I was still doing it. I felt like I had to go down with the ship. Like, I believe I said those words to myself on more than one occasion, just going down with the ship. Like, it's never going to treat your creative or mental health very well to have that mindset. And, but I stayed on and it was just sapping the life out of me. And then I went into like 1-900 Hot Dog working with Sean Baby, who even before I learned about Cracked was my favorite comedy writer just ever. He was great, a huge influence. And I was so high on that that I just threw myself fully into that. But then I also wanted to finish up Carrier Wave. I was working on Carrier Wave. And in that last part where this is going really well, I know exactly what I need to change. I'm wrapping it up. I started new projects and I just really wanted to keep working. So I did keep working and I paid the price. Like I definitely, it hasn't been great for my mental health to just abandon everything to work in the middle of a pandemic. And I think maybe that was kind of a defensive mechanism, you know, like seeing the world, so much of the world, not just the pandemic, but so much of the world go to chaos. Like you want to do something you have control over. So this isn't just an activity. This isn't just me like tending to a plant because I have control. I have control over the whole world. This is mine. I do all of this. So like, why not? Why not throw yourself into that? And I've been extremely productive until I completely fell apart. So yeah, don't do that. I should have done more stuff, mental health. I don't have any mental health tips aside from don't do that. Don't do what I did.
I was doing a recording with Pierce Brown last night and he's talking about editing or he's talking about meditation and journaling and self-help and I'm thinking, man, how do you manage all of that? And also, you know, put out books like I've been trying to lose weight and I've been fairly successful so far. But I still feel like either I can exercise and watch my eating or I can be a productive author. I don't know how to do both.
Yeah, I'm trying to find that balance where there's just so much I want to do. There's so many projects. There's so many things I want to give each of them the full attention that they deserve so that they can be the best thing they can possibly be. And that takes time. It takes time. It takes effort. And I also really want to do and have to do my day job.
Yeah.
And I have all of these things that I really truly want to do them. So it's kind of it's like a Twilight Zone curse where I have all the work I want that is great And then I love to do it. I want to do it. It's going really well. But you also have to do everything else. You have to take care of yourself. You have to eat food like an idiot. You have to go outside and you have to walk your dogs and experience love. It's like just, who has time for it? You got to make time for it. And I could be better about it.
Are you one of those people that when you're in a funk or when you're in like a really like in the zone, do you eat too much or too little?
It's kind of both in that I won't eat maybe sometimes all day. And then I'll come out and I'll be like, I need a 3-pound burrito. And I'll eat the entire 3-pound burrito and be like, I should not have had that 3-pound burrito. But like I'll just remember to do it all at once. And then like, hey, and I'm having GI issues. Don't do that. Don't do that either. Like, don't do any of the things. If I had a life coach, they would have just put a big X over my whole deal. Just, nope. Gonna have to figure out something else.
Yeah. Do you find that I mean, I guess maybe this is a loaded question because like we just had like the Bo Burnham special was kind of all about this, like creating comedy during like a plague. Does that feel weird to you or natural?
It feels fairly natural to me now. It was certainly because we started it. We started this in February of 2020.
Yeah.
It didn't launch until March, but we wanted to have like a backlog and we wanted to, you know, handle all the business stuff and have it really just ready to go and set up. So we started it in February and they were just talking about it. Like you were just starting to be worried about it. Is this going to be something or is this like going to be SARS where it's bad? It's bad in, you know, the places that it is, but it never touches us here. Is it something that I personally have to worry about or that we have to worry about, you know, in a larger sense? Nobody at that point really knew.
Yeah.
And then right as we launch in March, it starts to really hit and anybody that's paying attention is like, oh, this is a very bad thing. And so it felt irresponsible at times. And I had my book launch for Carrier Wave around that time. That was way harder for me to do because with the feedback I had from 1-900-HOT-DOG, people signing up for it and people discovering us were like, I just need something that's not the news. It's not politics. It's not Trump. It's not the pandemic. It's not global warming. It's just like, it's really been really good for my mental health to like read this and just laugh at something with very low stakes for me personally or the world. And I don't mean to disparage them, but it's not, you know, it's not like The Daily Show where you're learning about something and you're laughing. And it's also like a call to action. It's just a release valve and that's all it is. And people really appreciated that. But then I came out with a book that it wasn't about the pandemic. It was about like a signal that spreads like a noise, but that's pandemic adjacent enough that I felt really weird.
Yeah.
Like trying to plug people here, you guys read this and you might, it's not about the pandemic, but you might see something adjacent to it. And that's not great because like some bad stuff happens in the book here, buy it to reflect the world out there. So I was really messed up trying to promote that book more than the site. The site felt okay to launch into, probably because I got that positive feedback as we were doing it. Like you put out an article, takes you, you know, a week to write it. The next day it's up and people are talking about it and they're telling you what they like about it or what they didn't, if they didn't, how it helped them. It's just, man, there's that dopamine rush from being an author where you get good reviews for your book, only it's kind of small scale and every day.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask about that because you have, when you're creating content, like as much as you do, it feels to me, creating that much content sounds really stressful, like trying to get something out and on a weekly or many times a week, because I write these big fat novels that I can take a year or 2 years on and perfect them and sculpt them until bam, it's there. But also, like you said, that dopamine rush of putting little things out and actually having people respond to what you're doing in not necessarily real time, but in a much more regular fashion.
Yeah, brains are nuts. Brains are nuts. They do some wild things. And that's definitely like, you can almost get addicted to it where like if you take a hiatus from it after you do this for a long time, if you put out something every week for like 6 months and then you're like, something comes up, I need to take a month off, you can spiral. Your brain just, it doesn't have that like feedback. You're like, oh, well now I'm worthless. Like nobody's enjoying a thing that I did. Even if I'm working on a book at the same time or something that like personally I'm being productive and I'm being creative and I should feel good about it. If I'm used to that hit and I take it away, it's just like a withdrawal. Like you're just, now I'm worthless because I don't have a thing out there right now. So I'm being forgotten. I'm being made obsolete. And like, none of this even mattered. And you got to stop and try to wrestle your brain out of that and be like, no, we're doing this thing now. It's okay. We'll go back and do that thing. It doesn't have, it's not, we don't have to crash afterwards, but man, you can get addicted to anything. That addiction cycle just works on anything. People get addicted to anime girls and mobile games and will spend $800,000 on them. And I can't really even blame them for that because I have my own stupid addictions.
Right. I think everybody does, you know, whether it's chocolate or video games or whatever. You know, as long as your addiction is not killing you quickly or killing other people, you know, then it's probably for the best.
I mean, not quickly. It's not killing me quickly. So it's fine.
I mean, all of our stuff is killing us slowly, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah, nobody's making out of this one clean. That's true.
We're all going to die, and that's okay. It's kind of, I feel like that's become my mantra.
Yeah. I mean, once you're at peace with that, as we all are increasingly learning to be,
yeah.
What's left, you know? World's your oyster. Well, so what? I'm going to die. It's probably not great in the long term. I'm sure a psychologist will tell me all about that. I don't need to hear your nerd words about mental health. Prefer to ignore it.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
How old were you when you started with Cracked?
I was 27 when I started with Cracked. That was 2007. That was my first article. I responded to like a call for writers that they did. They used to post them every Thanksgiving. So it was November 2007. And then where anybody could just go into a writer's workshop that they had and you'd pitch something.
Yeah.
And they had a bunch of guides for like, this is what we want to do. This is how you can like try to come up with an angle for an article. This is how we want to see your pitch formatted. And then they would come back, somebody would come back personally on your pitch and say yes or no, first of all. And if it was a hard no, they'd try to like give you some general writing advice. If it was a soft no, that you always tried to give them advice like, here's how to improve it for us specifically. Here's what we would like to see. And you could go back and forth on that for a little while and then eventually accept it or not accept it and write it. So I went into that system and I started writing the articles and they would give me feedback and I would come back. And I just kept getting them accepted. I think I had like 10 accepted in a row, which nobody else had done. So they were finally like, okay, do you want a job?
Yeah.
Yes, clearly I was doing IT support at a college. And I don't know anything about computers. I mean, I know like a little, I know the same amount as you, but that whole job, I was just like on the razor's edge. I was one Google ahead of being fired all the time. So like, yeah, when they said, do you want a job? And offered me at first just a contractor position, which was not a ton of money, but it was more than I had ever made at that point in my life. I now recognize was not like enough to live on for like a reasonable person, totally enough to live on for me at that time. It was just, yes, this will buy me all the Pabst and ramen that I could ever want. And so I accepted it. And then they just kept liking it. And I got, you know, went from a contractor to a better position, became a columnist, just all from, you know, submitting to this one time call for writers and following through and just listening to feedback. Here's how to make it better.
That's kind of cool. I like, cause you and I had a kind of a similar discussion a few years back at Tucson Festival of Books. Mm-hmm. Where I'm sure you are aware of this, but I feel like that there are a lot of people now in their 30s and 40s who kind of grew into internet adulthood by reading Cracked every day.
Yeah, we get a lot of men. I'm still there with a lot of those people who followed us to 1-900 Hot Dog and stuff. We have people that were our age that, you know, we're along for the ride, but there are also people who are like, yeah, I read this as a teenager, and now you're like a 26-year-old and you're rubbing that in my face.
Yeah.
And now I'm an adult. You know, can't be an adult if you were reading my work when you were like a 12-year-old. It's insane. But yeah, there's some of them there that definitely came along with a cultural moment to kind of grow up to. And I get that a lot. And it's a crazy amount of responsibility that I really don't like to think about.
I guess I wouldn't frame it in terms of you have any responsibility there. I just think it's kind of cool that you were like, honestly, when we first met, I kept thinking how cool it was that I was talking to someone who was involved in that kind of framing of a huge part of my kind of online life for many years. And I imagine that there's quite a few listeners that probably feel the exact same way.
Yeah, for a lot of people, it was a very important part of, at the very least, a daily routine. Like everybody said, I would, for like 5, 6, 7 years there, every day at work, I would open it up and Cracked would be like the good part of my morning.
Right.
And then other people just read us, you know, at school, or they followed along and had a much larger influence than any of us. I thought any of us had certainly conceived, but also really understood. Like, it's hard to understand when you see those numbers on like Cracked back in the day. They've taken the hit counter off now because it became embarrassing. But when Cracked back at our peak, like anything that I wrote would see 500,000 readers. And I would just think, I can't think about that or I'm going to die. I'm just going to curl into a ball and die to just think about 500,000 people reading whatever this bullshit it was that I did this week. So yeah, there was some sort of like the influence. I should not have that number of people taking my thoughts into their body. It's not healthy. But yeah, the responsibility of that was paralyzing. Even if nobody gave me any response, even if it was just a number, the responsibility of that number was oftentimes terrifying, the success that we saw.
Do you think comedy is a responsibility? You know, because like there's some element of that has been monetized these days. I mean, you can go back to The Daily Show under Jon Stewart. You could go to Last Week Tonight. There's a bunch of stuff that is kind of has created its own responsibility as like a comedy, but like watchdog sort of news thing. But like just regular old comedy of writing jokes and just getting a chuckle out of people. Is there a responsibility there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not doctor responsibility. It's maybe not even like really good mechanic responsibility. But there's something there in that these people are choosing to spend oftentimes their money, certainly their free time and attention in the internet era of today where you have video games that can take you to another world. You have these fucking crazy movies that are just amazing and have all the money in the world. You have great books and comic books and podcasts, and there's entertainment, and your time can be spent for free or for very little money on anything in the world. So somebody choosing to pay attention to you, it's kind of a responsibility not to let them down, to at least give everything you have to it.
Yeah.
I just got no respect for a half-assed comedians that toss something out. Because a lot of people, especially in the YouTube era, will talk about how easy it is for them. I just toss this out in like 20 minutes, and that's kind of a brag for them. And I think that's disrespectful. I think that's the respect you got to have of putting the thought and the time and the effort into it, even if it's just a dumb joke about comic books or whatever. If you're supposed to care about it, because people could be doing so much better with their time than listening to your jokes, and they're choosing not to, and maybe give you money. So yeah, it's something.
I wonder, do you kind of take that line of thought further with, because like I've talked about this with a couple of my guests on the podcast, but there's kind of a controversy over it in my little corner of novelisting. With Epic Fantasy and a couple of the big authors who just don't produce. Do you have similar thoughts on that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a very different thing to me. Just not producing. I'm trying to set aside my personal feelings because you're also a reader of these things, and I am a fan of these things, which we shall not mention because they're very big bridges and we don't want to burn them. I don't have enough fire to burn that bridge.
Right.
but I'm also a fan of those things. So personally, as a fan, I understand. I want more of those. I want closure on that story. That's, you know, sort of a social contract. But on the other hand, if that person really doesn't have it, or if they just don't have it right now, do you want that? from them? Do you want a terrible effort? Because there was this big show that has probably nothing to do with what we're talking about, this big HBO show. And people got that hasty effort to wrap it up, and they were not happy. They would,
right.
If you would ask them, would you have rather this just not happened? They would have said, yes, I would rather you have just maybe tragically canceled after season 5 or something. And we had a lot to revisit and a lot of fun and a lot of cool stuff. And maybe somebody can pick it up again someday and we'll get that movie resolution or whatever. It's better than closing it the wrong way. So if they don't have it, or if they don't have it right now, I think it's probably the smart move to not do it.
That's I feel like that's surprisingly generous, to be honest. And I think that you're right in a lot of ways. It's interesting because everybody feels differently about it. And you can have both fans and other authors. Everybody kind of has a different opinion and a different and, you know, some people won't go on the record on it and some people will. And it's interesting how everybody has their own kind of take.
Yeah, but everybody's got such a hot take about that particular topic. Like, it's a few people, me, for example, have tepid takes on it. But but people are just real spicy about that. And it's surely, I guess I wasn't paying attention before this, but it's surely happened before in history.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I think the internet must be fueling and connecting and certainly giving longer legs to like that outrage.
I would imagine, especially with like social media and, you know, the average fan has pretty easy access to, you know, 80% of the authors that they like, just because they can say, oh, this author is cooking some brioche this morning. You can see anything on social media. And
it's unprecedented access. It's amazing. Like, could you imagine when we were kids going to like school or something and finding a book club, not just for like the genre you like, not just for even just books, just finding somebody else that read books would have been amazing, but finding like a huge fan club for one specific author, or even narrower to one specific work by that author. And you find out there's like 20 kids in this room that just want to talk about like the first book of Dragonlance. Like, what? It would have blown your mind. You would never find somebody that was on your particular wavelength. And now everybody has that for everything all the time. And then, yeah, you can lose perspective in that room real quick. You can get that room real riled up and stay that way for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I think there is an aspect of that that's super cool, that fandoms and stuff like that can meet and be together.
It's very cool, yeah.
But like, there's also part of that that's, you know, that has, it's the same cancer of any social media stuff, where it's like, where it becomes too much of a good thing, and then people start getting angry all the time about topics that don't matter at all. And that's weird to me.
I mean, it's that same feedback loop I was talking. You can get addicted to anything. People can get addicted not just to social media, but very specifically the anger they feel about things on social media. And then you just come there. This is where I go to get mad. And then I get mad and I feel really good about like what I've done while I was mad. And then I'm going to go do something else. And I'm going to come right back here in an hour and see like the results of my anger. And that's addicting. You've got a feedback loop now. You've got a gameplay loop to come back to. Just gamifying fury. And it's dangerous, but yeah, it's also very cool. Like I said, you can go find that fandom for that one thing. When I was a kid, I couldn't talk to anybody about almost anything. I had to find like the big mainstream thing that was kind of close to the thing I liked. And maybe we could talk about Star Wars together or something. That was big enough that you could find somebody else into it. But if you wanted to get any more niche than that, you were just alone, basically, until then. So it's done some, I mean, it's like anything else. You've done some amazing things, and it's got some cancer growing on it that I don't know we can get rid of. I think it's kind of part of it.
Yeah. Do you, so I'm actually I don't know anything about the comedy book world, because in at least in genre fiction, it's Terry Pratchett and like, that's it. Like Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams. Is that a thing out there or that I'm totally missing? Or am I kind of accurate in saying that that's kind of the big stuff?
Yeah. I mean, just like I'm doing, I don't really write comedy books first, aside from like my first book, which was nonfiction. And that's an entirely different world than what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, if people don't appreciate that, everything works different in nonfiction. It's sold differently. It's published differently. It's worked on differently. Different people read it. Different standards apply. I think there's plenty of room for straight comedy books in like biography and nonfiction. But yeah, in terms of your catch 22 or your like Confederacy of Dunces, I don't know that anybody's doing straight comedy books anymore. I'm sure somebody is, but it's not somebody I've heard of. So yeah, I'm certainly doing it too. I'm doing genre comedy. I do mostly horror comedy. Carrier Wave was played a little bit straighter, but it still had tons of moments of comedy. That's kind of more how I do it, is I write the genre book and then there's comedy in it.
Right.
And I think that works pretty well. It works for me. It's what I want to do. I think that's probably the big thing right now. But yeah, we used to have, you know, flagship straight up comedy book titles. And that sort of seems to, if not went away, certainly fallen by the wayside.
Would you have any theories on why we don't really see that?
I don't know. I think maybe just comedy went in enough other directions, in enough other places, that if you want to laugh, like, the world's your oyster, you know, you can look for comedy in tons of your favorite shows that also do this, this, and this, that also supply this character arc, that also supply, you know, this world building or some other mechanic that you're interested in. You can find humor in your video games. It used to be, everything used to be much more straightforward before media was everywhere and everything. So there was a space where I feel like laughing. I certainly don't have a TV in my pocket to watch The Honeymooners or whatever. I'm going to bring this funny book with me. That was your option. And now I do have this thing in my pocket that will show me a really good stand-up comedian if I want. It'll show me all the Whitest Kids You Know sketches if I want to revisit them. It'll show me whatever comedy I want. I think it's so much focus to like sit with a book, you know? And we have to make them care about characters and follow comedy arcs and follow character arcs and to work comedy into that as well. It's a hard trick to pull off, and to do it in a straight comedy book might just be too difficult to like really get mainstream anymore.
It certainly seems like a very, you want the rise and fall, and you don't want your book to be totally serious all the time. And so, you know, you want to break things up a little bit. So you have little funny bits or whatever. And, you know, some people are heavier on it. Some people are lighter. But man, the straight up, I need to write a joke on every page kind of thing, that feels like it would be such a skill set.
I mean, that's what we do on the site, is that we just write something dense with jokes. And it's got its own build and its own angle and its own flow.
Yeah.
But it's also asking only a little bit of somebody's time. It's saying, here's 15 minutes that I want out of your day to read this thing and experience it. And that's a trick. It's so hard to get people to do that.
Yeah.
to just read a comedy thing. And that's only 15 minutes. A book, you're asking, like, depending on how fast you read, how long the book is, like 8 hours, 10 hours of their life, straight up to these jokes. It can be exhausting. And it's certainly exhausting as a prospect to be like, well, maybe I only want 15 minutes of those jokes. So maybe I'm not going to buy that book. Maybe I want 2 hours. Maybe I'm going to watch that movie. It's just, I think it's spoiled for choice and people chose not to do that.
Have you ever been intrigued by or tried to get into the more performative aspect of comedy, doing stand up or acting or anything like that? Or are you much more comfortable behind the keyboard?
Fuck no. I would hate that. No, I'm way more comfortable behind the keyboard, but the sort of necessity of at least the podcast,
yeah,
has definitely brought me out and made me do that. I've forced myself to do that. I have fun. I enjoy it. After I talk for like 2 hours or so, my voice just gives out. That's how big of an introvert I am. My body is physically not trained to like perform.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. And like, I don't, man, I'll tell a story, barely related story. I was, For the Unnoticeables, the Vicious Circuit series, they did a pretty good press tour for the first book, at least.
Yeah.
And they booked all of these things. They set them all out and they were like, okay, here's the itinerary we have for you. We've got you going to this con. You're going to this place and doing a reading the next day. And then you're going to this con the next day. And you're going to these two places to do readings. And then day after that, you're going to this con up here. And nobody ever thought to ask me, hey, have you ever read anything you've ever written in public before? Because the answer was no.
Oh, man.
I had no idea what to do. And the very first time I had to like speak in public to anything more than like a college classroom was San Diego Comic-Con on a panel.
Oh, no.
On a panel with some of the biggest names.
Oh.
That I don't want to repeat for a couple of reasons. But there was like 3,000 people in attendance, and it was the
Jeez. It
was the first thing I had ever been asked to do, and just walking into Comic-Con as kind of an introvert was just shut down. Yeah. I have no idea what to do. I had no idea what to do with my body, like where to go or what, how to stand. And then I met, I don't know, 800 other writers that day. And I was supposed to like mix and meet their names and meet them and remember their names and then go to do this panel and then do a huge book signing. And then like, and then the next day they sent me to like do a reading. I was like, okay, well, I'm braced for this. And I showed up and there was like three people there. So now this is the other side of the coin where I've never read anything I've done to a room full of less than like a college course. So when it's three people and you're just like, which one do I look at? Do I look at Dave?
Oh, man.
Because here's Dave. Do I look at Beth? Hi, Beth. What about Marty? Marty's over here. That's it. Like, it's wildly different skill sets that they threw me into. And I was not at all prepared for it. Nobody had prepared me for it. I didn't have time or inclination to take classes. Like, I am not, it has not been my jam at all. And I'm getting more into it with the podcasts coming out of it. But like, that was my trial by fire. And I got over the nerves of it. But it's also, man, it's a skill set to be publicly and in person entertaining when it's not just like drunk with your friends at a bar. Because I rule at that. I'm great drunk with my friends at a bar. It does not apply. It does not transfer over to like sketch comedy, which is just, it's so hard. Like what those people do. It's so hard to be an actor, an entertainer, somebody in person. It's not like I write the funny joke so I can do this. Because sometimes you think that, and you are incorrect if you think that.
I'm always amazed at writers who will go out and like go to a convention, and it doesn't matter the size of the room, whether it's big or small, but they'll work the crowd and they'll be perfect for an hour.
Yeah, those sons of bitches.
And I kind of hate their guts.
Yeah, a lot.
Like, and you just don't.
It was like the first time. It was like seeing John Hamm outside of like the Don Draper role.
Oh.
And like, he's great in it. And you're like, he's a handsome man. He's a great actor. And then he goes on like 30 Rock and he's really funny. And then you see him in an interview and he's super friendly and everybody loves him. And you're like, fuck you. What are you doing? You can't do this.
Yeah. You can't be intelligent and talented and nice. Like, at least be an asshole behind the scenes.
Right.
Because then we can talk about you behind your back.
You have to pick one thing because I am barely one thing and I can't do two. And slowly over like a decade, I'll learn to do two. But like,
yeah,
people out there doing everything. And I don't understand them. I'm not that beast. I was never that beast.
I always wanted to be that beast.
Who doesn't want to be that beast? It's a magnificent beast.
Yeah, there's a point at which you're just like, nah, I got to accept who I am.
Yeah, certainly after that whole Comic-Con tour, I was like, okay, I can do this. I can do parts of this. I'm never going to be that guy. I'm never going to be like, they put me on a panel with somebody that just owns it. And you're like, I'm the guy that has to just, I'll come in with a joke here or there, maybe an observation, but you got to let that other person shine if they're going to.
Yeah.
So yeah. I can't fight you for that room. Like, it's just going to be Nixon sweating on TV at that point. Everybody's going to be like, oh, this is unpleasant.
Well, and I'm sure you've been on panels and plenty of listeners will have gone to panels with people up there who,
yeah,
there's somebody who doesn't have it, but really wants it and will fight for it. And that it always feels so awkward.
Yeah, it's so much worse than if somebody realizes they don't have it and will just chip in once in a while and are like, let the other person shine. You can still come away with a positive impression of them. You'd just be like, oh, that's not their thing, but their book sounded interesting. They were pretty funny or interesting or whatever. Versus if you think, I'm going to take this, it makes it unpleasant for everybody.
I got put on a military fantasy panel once with a couple of reasonably big authors. And it was, you know, it was probably 300 people or so in the room. And but like everybody else on the panel was like ex-military or like huge gun nuts and like, like, or historians or something like that. And I'm sitting there like, oh man, I just write what I think is fun. Like, that's it. I don't have any qualifications.
I like to do the stories.
Yeah.
You guys. Don't put me on anything that requires any expertise other than like what I have just done. A lot of times I've been put on like comedy in something, comedy in horror, comedy in writing, comedy in like genre fiction. That's great. I can tell jokes and talk to you about what I think about comedy. But if you put me on anything that's like more advanced than that, if it's military or whatever, I haven't done a military thing. If it's historical, don't put me on anything that requires any secondary field of expertise. I know some of these people are like ex-tacticians or whatever that have then gone into books. I'm like an ex nothing. I'm a current book. I'm a current book guy.
I always feel weird because I didn't have a career before I became an author. Like, I worked a couple of crap jobs, and you meet those people who are like, oh yeah, I was an anthropologist for 30 years. And you're like, oh, you're like a real human.
Oh, you know stuff, huh? Yeah. No, I was failing IT support until I started writing comedy. And then they're like, yeah, do that. So that's what I do. And yeah. I didn't even know IT support. I couldn't tell you a single thing that is relevant to the computers of today. I was a waiter before that. I was a terrible waiter. It's just a god-awful waiter. Couldn't tell you anything about how to wait tables. Pretty much just jokes and stories. That's all I got.
But trying to compete with somebody who has like a real skill set is, it's always like, come on, man, leave a little for the guy who just makes some shit up.
Or just don't put that guy on the panel. It's fine. I can miss that room.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It'll be okay. Well, hey, man, I've been keeping you a long time, but I like to end these with asking a particular question, but I'm not sure it'll apply to you as we've already discussed some of your eating habits. What's the last thing you ate that just blew your mind, that you still think about that food?
Oh, man. You know what? I had an amazing burger, and I'm mostly off of red meat these days, especially now after my GI system just went to hell. Like, a burger will kill me outright, but every once in a while, I'd go have a burger. I had this amazing burger, just medium rare, caramelized onions, like this fancy, it's some sort of whiskey-infused bacon thing.
Oof.
It was on and this is the other important part, just as important, if not more important. It was on a sunny day on like an outdoor patio with like a nice beer in my hand. And it was just such a good moment. And I'm so mad that I can't go do that like tomorrow.
Ah, man. Those, you know, that's something that I think you don't talk about. Like real chefs will talk about like setting and everything like that, but man, like, mm-hmm. like the setting of what you're eating can really affect it. Like my wife and I went to like a really fancy local Italian place right after we moved to Utah, and the food was good, but like it was so fancy that it was packed on a weeknight with shoulder to shoulder. Like, there was no room between the tables.
Yeah.
And we just never talk about that night. Like, it was a non thing, even though we spent like $400. Like, and that's like disappointing. But like, honestly, I would trade that for what you just described. Like, a perfect sunny day and a burger. Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, not too crowded. It wasn't even that crowded. We went in like a weekday, like you said, and there was nobody at the tables next to us. And it was wonderful. And I look forward to doing whatever equivalent I can do. Some damn chicken sandwich, all right? I'll find a chicken sandwich that's really good, and I'll do that. Chicken sandwich and, I don't know, an iced tea, I guess, is my equivalent. Oh, that sounds so sad.
You know what? People crap on chicken. I love chicken.
Learning to.
I think you can do anything with chicken.
Yeah, you sure can. I'm going to miss the beer part of that, though.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That was novelist and comedy columnist Robert Brockway. Thanks again to Robert for taking the time to chat with me. You can find links to Robert's website, Patreon, and social media down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. Don't forget to like and subscribe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.